And you're welcome to the RTE Rugby Podcast ahead of Ireland against Wales in the Six Nations at the Aviva this weekend. Coming up on the show, we're going to speak to former Ireland coach Eddie O'Sullivan in just a couple of minutes' time. Alongside me in studio, Mick Glennon of RTE Sport Online. How are you, Mick?
How are you doing, Hugh?
I'm okay after last weekend. I'm not great, I'll be honest with you, but we'll pick apart maybe little bits of the performance levels last week. And later on, we're going to speak to Simon Thomas from Wales Online to get the view in Wales after Wayne Pivac's pretty impressive start, albeit against Italy. But there seems to be a bit of a mixed bag this week. After Scotland, the win was great, but the manner of the win maybe not so much.
Yeah, if you were to just take it from the immediate reaction of the Irish team and management, everything seemed a bit rosy in the garden for my liking. I suppose a lot of the analysts and pundits came out afterwards and said, you know, believe what you see, not what you hear. And I, you know, there was certainly no indication that the confidence that had been so damaged and so bruised over 2019 had been reinvigorated, or that they had got back to the sense of their true selves, you know, that maybe it's a lot more to be done and even might not happen in this competition about getting back to where they were.
Yeah, it does seem to be confidence was something that was thrown out last weekend. And let's just bring in Eddie O'Sullivan if we can now. Eddie, good to talk to you as always. And look, I know we've kind of rehashed a lot of last weekend over the past few days, but just from a coach's perspective and from your perspective, to get Ireland to the level where they were out-muscled and bullied by Scotland is a worrying sign from last weekend, was it not?
Yeah, it was. I think they were caught a bit cold, actually. If you go back to the game in Yokohama, that game we won was won after 20 minutes because I think we just bullied Scotland a lot less, and they played way below par. So if you listen to their remarks after the game in Yokohama, they were embarrassed how badly they played, and they basically got beaten up by us. We didn't actually do anything except run over them. So we tend to forget that game, everybody, and just move on to the next one and the next one, the next one. So you've got to think, when Scotland are coming to town last weekend, what's the one thing that they're not going to let happen? And that's, they're not going to let themselves be bullied again. And if you looked at the team that Gregor Townsend picked, he made a lot of changes from the game in the World Cup. And they just went to make sure that they weren't going to get pushed around. So they were going to be ultra-aggressive, and they were ultra-aggressive. We didn't seem to expect that. We were caught cold by that. You could tell in the first 5 minutes even, they came out of some waves and we were soaking tackles. And I think that upset us a bit, because that's not usually our MO. We usually, you know, meet fire with fire when it comes to the contact area. But we emboldened Scotland in the first 10 minutes and they felt like, yeah, it's on here today, let's keep it going. So I think that knocked us out of our stride a bit.
Just on that then, Eddie, right, it's really interesting, because like the last couple of weeks, and since Andy Farrell really has taken over, right, we've been hearing very much about that it's a much more relaxed camp, right? It's not as intense as it was under Joe Schmidt. The players feel a little bit more able to express themselves, right? And that's great. But that clearly resulted in Ireland walking out of the pitch against Scotland last week and thinking, sure, we have these guys' number. Sure, we beat them only a few months ago. We don't have to be as intense as perhaps we were under Joe Schmidt to undo it. And that wasn't the case.
Well, I don't think there's a conscious recognition of that, but it might be unconscious. Plus the fact, maybe, you know, I don't know what they did in camp, but they seem to do a lot more planning than actual, you know, hard training. I mean, they have five sessions. And then add to the fact that maybe they were happy that their defence was okay, so they didn't put a lot of emphasis on it. They put more emphasis on the attack, and maybe they got their balance, their preparations a little bit off. But if you're looking for reasons, I think that was the first reason that struck me on Saturday, that we were going to have a bit of a humdinger of a game, is that, like, Scotland were up for it and we weren't quite ready, and it's not that we missed many tackles, you know. I mean, our conversion rate, well, it wasn't great, but we've had similar conversion rates and defended better. I thought it was just the intensity of our contact, you know, that they were hitting us and making 2 or 3 metres on a carry. And it's very hard then to get the ball back. And that emboldened them to play the way they played. And they were on the line as well. The other thing is, they were on the line, which in a funny way, I mean, they were in their physicality, they were just on the bubble of going too far sometimes and being over aggressive. And as a consequence, that hurt them as well. throughout the game. If you think of the silly penalties they gave away, the obstructions and you know, and got off their feet at the ruck, that undid them in another way. But the fact that they brought that intensity, I don't think we were ready for it. So that was the first marker that went down on Saturday for me, is that we weren't ready for this onslaught, and we should have seen it coming, because Scotland basically hadn't much else in their locker except to throw the kitchen sink at us physically, and it seemed to get what it set out to achieve has upset us a little bit.
Do you know, it reminded me of somewhat of the Japan match in the World Cup, where we kind of misjudged our opponent, and before we knew it, the game was kind of getting away from us, and Scotland immediately sensed that not everything was right in the camp, and they piled on at a time, and they should have levelled up, and it really looked like they had the momentum, and all of a sudden Ireland in this kind of has zoned out and not able, and before you know it, the game's gone.
Because Eddie, how hard is it for a team like that when you find yourself maybe a couple of feet back from where you should be to try and fix it on the hoof, if you like, or on the pitch? How difficult is it?
It's actually a very difficult thing to do, because the other team have kind of got the smell of blood and they're going for it, and you kind of need to find some way to kind of rally the troops and flip the switch, but it's easier said than done. You know, they've given them a reason to play. Now, what Ireland did was, when we had the ball, we kicked it away a bit as well and brought them onto us. So I thought we should have held on to the ball a bit more than we did. One of the ways to turn that back is to get the ball, run harder, to make them make tackles, and then you bring your aggression into the game. But if you kick the ball to them, they're coming back on top of you again. And there's a lot of that where Ireland kicked the ball away, not particularly well, as Scotland came roaring back at us. Now, the irony of that is when we did hold on to the ball and we did go at them, they did struggle. Like, they weren't able to contain us by the virtue of the fact they gave away so many penalties. So kind of our saving grace on Saturday was that when we ran at them, they gave away penalties. And that really was, when you think we only scored one try, we actually scored four kicks at goal from there in discipline at the ruck. And the other side of that is what saved us last Saturday is that when they ran at us, the one thing saved us, we got crucial turnovers at key moments in the game, where we were looked like we were in deep trouble. There was one at the very back end, at the very end of the game, which DJ Stander got all the credit for, and rightly so. It's a fantastic turnover on our goal line. But if you rewind the clock, Keelan Doris got the first one of the game, again, 10 metres from our goal line in the first 3 minutes of the game. And they were the moments that kind of took the wind out of Scotland's sails with those key turnovers. But had we not got those key turnovers overs, there's a good chance they'd have picked a few scores up that they didn't get. And now I think that the game now is on the line, really. And that's how close it was, you know, when you step back from it. The fact that they were able to bully us, they held onto the ball, they really, you know, didn't give us anything except indiscipline. And we cashed in that. At the same time, at the other end of the equation, when they attacked us, we were able to turn over the ball. That really decided how we won the game, which is not a kind of the way you would have said this game will play out an hour before it. You had a completely different vision of how it might play out.
Where do you fall down on the Conor Murray performance? Do you think it's as bad as some people have suggested, or his box kicking in particular, or would you be more reasons for optimism?
I don't hate a bad performance. I mean, I've been critical of him in the build-up because I think Cooney is playing the better rugby at the moment. So, but what happens when a player comes under criticism is people look for every minor error and they blow it up, you know. So I think he's been over-criticised. I still don't think he's out playing Cooney. I still think Cooney is the better bet at the moment. And that's what all the heat is about, really. But I thought he did okay. He still hasn't changed gears for me. I mean, some of his kicks were poor. Again, he didn't really threaten around the fringes. So I still think he's kind of flatlined in his performance. Now, he's still a very good scrum half. But we're talking about comparing us to another guy who's playing with his socks. So I wouldn't be beating Conor Murray up after last week. I mean, he wasn't the reason that we didn't get the sparkling performance we were hoping for. But I still think he's under the gun. And I'm a little bit surprised he's still there again this week. So
Eddie,
I think that creates more heat around that whole decision.
But have you noticed, obviously one of Conor Murray's strengths going back is his box kicking, but defences now across the board have come up with a kind of a new tactic. They're flooding that channel and they're kind of doing it more, apart from the one at the end, they're doing it with a lot more subtlety, that the referee's not able to give a penalty because there's guys wandering gently into the line and there's two or three guys there. So that tactic is kind of outdated as opposed to Murray's kicking being slightly off.
Yeah, I think that there's two things. There's two bits to that, Michael. There's the fact that Ireland have been figured out in terms of their box kick. So even when Ireland box kick well now, teams are picking players in the backfield and they're running good. They're good, running good cover lines to give the catcher a chance to get under the ball. That's the first thing. So we've kind of overplayed the box kick and it came back and bit us, you know, over time. But the other thing is, I don't think Connor's kicking the ball that well anyway. Some of those box kicks are too far. And I think that, you know, when he's not, every one of those that isn't on the money, people now know what a box kick's supposed to do. And they know what it looks like. And when it's not, doesn't look good, people are saying, oh, it's another bad kick. So he's getting a bit of heat on that. The thing that really, more than anything, that I'm, I suppose I would say Conor Murray has taken out of this game is his ability to make breaks. Like, to me, when Conor Murray, if we go back even 2 years and more, Conor Murray was a nightmare to defend around the rocks because he's a huge man. I think he's about 6'2". He's a really good, quick couple of first steps. And he sells a beautiful dummy. Remember the try in Chicago? Straight under the sticks.
For the Lions then as well. And
exactly. He's able to. Now, that is absolutely evaporated out of his game in the last year and a bit.
Since the injury, Eddie, hasn't it really been? Since the injury? Since he come back?
Well, that's the interesting point you raise there. Like, it could be a factor, but it's just, it's like someone's told him not to do it anymore. And I remember last year, I mean, it seems kind of been really down the rushes, but when they beat Scotland last year in Murrayfield, they got a great try off a rolling play for Jacob Stockton, but they ran a little loop or a wraparound off the ruck. But Conor Murray made the pass for the wraparound. But if you freeze that video, when Conor Murray makes that pass, he could have actually ran the length of the field himself and scored a try. It was a massive hole around the ruck, and he passed the ball. And I said, that's not the Conor Murray we know. Conor Murray would have been through that gap a year earlier with his hair on fire. He'd been under the sticks. No, it didn't matter on the day because Stockdale scored. But my point is that that's not Conor Murray's MO as we know it. He's the guy who would be up and through that gap before anyone would see it. And that seems to have evaporated out of his game. Same for Munster. He did not, you know, he's not doing it for Munster. And if he's not doing it for Munster, he's going to find it even harder to do for Ireland because those gaps in front of Munster look the same for Ireland, but they're a lot smaller because of the pace of the game. So I would say that's the one part of Murray's game. I think if he brought that back into his game, if he prepares to have a crack, pin his ears back, it might just ignite something in him that seems to have kind of dissipated, that kind of dangerous guy around the rock. He's not a danger around the rock anymore. Yeah. And I'd love to see that coming back into his game. I don't know why he left his game, but I would argue with anybody that it's not there anymore. I haven't seen him for a while.
Mick, how did you find Andy Farrell this week around the team? What was his mood like?
No, he comes out and he's in a very good humour. It appears he has a different style about him. I mean, Joe was a headmaster and he always give off the ear of a headmaster.
Yeah.
And Andy has come up through the ranks, very young man when he was making his debut for Wigan. So he's in that environment a long time, personable, and even the rest of the guys as well. So
didn't seem concerned by facets of the play. Like, I mean, in terms of this week and looking ahead to Wales.
He certainly did mention there was a lot to work on.
Okay.
He was tending to give a lot of credit to Scotland, saying that that's the best they've played in a while. Notwithstanding they got a draw in Twickenham last year. But I would have thought that behind the scenes, they would be trying to get a lot better attitude up to the pitch of the match a lot sooner, working on that. We asked him about why the Welsh seem to be more passionate when they're playing for the country, because maybe they don't have an outlet through their clubs.
Yeah.
He said that the players had spoken about that today. So it is something that's on their mind about how they can reach the same pitch as the Welsh do.
Yeah, and I have to say, Eddie, looking at Wales this weekend, I know in the context of the opposition last weekend, you can't read too much into 42-0 against Italy, but Wayne Pivac, we know, is a very good coach. The Scarlets have kind of bared his stamp for the last few seasons very successfully, albeit the Welsh regions have struggled. But I'm worried about Wales this weekend. How do you see this matchup?
I would be worried about Wales, but I'm worried about the game, and I think I'm worried about not. I don't think Wales are going to bring anything too spectacular, for a couple of reasons. One, I think that they might be. I think they'll be better than last week in terms of the personnel, but I think they'll also be moving out of Cardiff, which is always a factor. Like, I don't care how you dice it. like Wales are not the same team outside of Cardiff as they are in Cardiff. So that's a plus to us. So I don't think they'll bring the same intensity if we were going to Cardiff this weekend, I'd be extremely worried. I really would. But we're not. So it's a moot point. The other thing I think is that really this week is down to us. We need to get back to where we want to be. And if we get back to where we want to be, there's no reason we won't beat Wales. But if we serve up anything short of that, we could get caught. And Wales will come pretty cocky. They're a cocky team and they'll play. But a lot with Wales, you've got to convince them early doors it's not their day. And if you do that, they usually pack their tent and go home. They're a team that you can give a message to them early, away from home. Doesn't happen in Cardiff for sure. So I think if we need to hit the ground running this week, and that will send a message to Wales, and that will set the platform to win. Now, what do we have to change? I think we have to bring a lot more intensity, and I think we have to, again, the game has to take another incremental step forward with the ball. So in defence, we've got to bone up and make big hits and be ultra-aggressive like we thought we should be last week and weren't. And when we have the ball, we have to see some more bells and whistles. Like, the first try last week was a beautiful score, well constructed off the training field, lovely to see it. But there was a couple of breaks here and there, but after that it was pretty barren territory. And we got one try in 80 minutes against Scotland. I can't remember the last time we got one try against Scotland in a championship game.
Yeah.
So we have to see the increment, because if we play to the same pitch with the ball last week as we did last week, we won't score enough points to win the game.
Do you know what? I was looking at France last weekend, Eddie, in the back line that they had, and look at some of the tries that they got, right? You know, Rate the winger, Dupont played brilliantly well as well, Vakatau making breaks. And I'm looking at our back line, and I'm looking at Jordan Larmour and what he can do, Andrew Conway, Robbie Henshaw as well, when he's on form and played in the right way, Stockdale, Sexton. Like, that back line for me, you know, on form, should be able to match up to and at least surpass most of the back lines in this tournament. And I just wonder, are we playing to our strengths, which seems to be the pace and agility we have in the back line, and not trying to back lads up front. So is that where you'd like to see maybe a shift in pattern and more focus on what we have out wide?
I would like to see the ball going out wide. Like the example I point to is that if you go, 2018 was the benchmark, and I know people say, oh, stop talking about 2018, that's gone, but for me it was a benchmark. And if you look at apart from the fact that we won the Grand Slam and beat the All Blacks, just look at what happened. Like, Jacob Stockdale was leading try scorer. He was scoring tries for fun. Why? Because he was getting the ball in his hands and he was getting the opportunity. Like, how many times can you remember Stockdale running in open space last week with the ball? The one he did have was from a restart, a 22-metre dropout that he actually collected. But we weren't able to construct any attacking phases for him to get into space. The one time, again, that Conway got away to space, Larmour had put his foot in touch, you know, up the touchline from inside their own 22. But that was from a counter-attack, from a kick. So we're not deconstructing teams with our attack and creating space and opportunities for our outside players, like, you know, Conway, Larmour and Stockdale.
And Larmour's one of the best counter-attackers in the game, certainly at club level at the moment, Eddie. I think he had 7 kick receipts against Scotland. Of those, he kicked back twice, but he didn't make a single line break. And that's not just down to him. We know he has the feet to beat players, but it surely involves the rest of the team supporting him when he does run it back.
I don't think we're set up for counter-attacking or a full-back, actually. I think our attacking setup is what and this came about last year when our defence was struggling a little bit. You know, and 18 was a great year, but we did have our foibles on defence. What Andy Farrell did is, and Joe Schmidt was the head coach, they pushed the wings up high. So the wings play up high, so that if team's going to go around us, that winger can plug in and fill a space quickly out wide. And one player makes a big difference in the outside channels. What's happened now when the ball's kicked to Larmour, he's kind of isolated in the backfield.
Yeah.
Usually counterattacks are built on the base of having at least 2 players in the backfield. And if you get a third player there, you have some chance to actually move the ball into a different channel or run a switch, dummy switch, or a loop around. Things that give you an opportunity to find a soft shoulder. But when you look at Larmour last week, when he caught those balls, he was pretty much in splendid isolation.
Yeah.
So if he doesn't make the break himself from the backfield, he's going to get tackled.
So two things had to happen there. It has to be players working to get back to support him, and also anticipating that the kick is going to come and realizing then that Larmour has the space to counter.
They could be, but I think that they need to review that, because they're playing the wings so high that they're not able to get back in time to create those opportunities.
Mm. Is it my imagination, or when you look at New Zealand or Super Rugby, that the guy who catches the ball almost always shifts it immediately? Just, I have that in my head, that any time I see it, the guy catching it passes it straight away, and it gives other angles and it allows him to support. And rarely, as Eddie's exactly pointing out, you rarely see that with Ireland.
No, you don't. And it's isolation for Larmour. So, I don't know. There seems to be a lot to fix, Eddie, in the space of like a week, you know?
There's a lot of stuff going on there. But look, they're all fixables, and they don't all have to be firing at 100% on the day. Like, if you make an improvement in all those areas, like, I think that against Wales, you know, the danger, and there's a couple of dangers with Wales, apart from all those, if you want to really get into it. One is, if we get too loose against Wales, they'll love that. So, you could be a bit looser against Scotland, because I don't think they can do as much damage. If we get loose against Wales and a game opens up, it actually suits Wales. And that's always been the way. It's been Wales like a loose game. So we have to be careful and a lot more strategic when we open up the game. And the second thing is, we've lost Gary Ringrose now, yeah, who to me was this outstanding back we've had for the last year, really. So, the midfield of Henshaw and Aki is not a midfield for moving the ball. Now, I say that because Robbie Henshaw, as a younger player, was an outside centre and full back. He's a beautiful footballer, but he hasn't really played at the top end of the game at outside centre enough. His game has been about playing a pretty direct Bosch role up the middle for 12 with Ireland over the last few years. So I don't know how they can rewire that midfield to get the ball to Conway, Larmour and Stockdale, but Ringrose out of the picture even if they wanted to. So I think they have more challenges there. And the fact is, if they are loose when they're doing that, Wales will cash in on that as well. So there's risks now about, there's risks there even if we try and expand the game and we don't get it right.
Yeah.
So I think they are under a bit of pressure this week. Like, I do think we'll see a shift in physicality. I think that they learned from last week that they were off the pace physically, and it took them a while to actually get a grip on the game. I don't think they'll make that mistake again in Wales. That's one thing that's easy to fix. That's between your ears.
Okay.
And I think they'll have that done. But tactically, they're going to have to make sure that they get the defence right. I think that would be better. But more importantly, I think they're going to have to move the ball a little bit more. They won't beat Wales up physically, but they've got to be very careful, because Wales will like a loose game, and they don't have Ringrose in the outside channel to marshal that transition. So there are concerns there. But look, they know the problems, and I think they may have got themselves undercooked last week. They talked about only training five times. I don't understand that. I mean, but I'm assuming they said, oh, well, everything else was done, you know, on the blackboard and on the video screens up out in Avidstone. There's nothing wrong with that as well. But maybe this week they might probably let the dogs out a bit more in training and get guys really honed in for the physicality of it.
Okay. Eddie, great stuff as always. Thanks so much.
Cheers, guys.
Eddie O'Sullivan there. Okay, we want to get the view from Wales, and I'm delighted to say we have Simon Thomas from Wales online with us on the line. He's been listening in patiently. Simon, you're very welcome. So can I ask you, first of all, what the reaction was around Wales camp to the performance and the victory against Italy last weekend? The opposition taken in for account, it seemed all in all a very good performance.
Yeah, it's pretty positive. I mean, if you think back, everyone's talked about what Sean Edwards has done with France, you know, the victory over England, and you know, he's a tremendous defensive coach. But in 12 years with Wales, in the Six Nations, he never nailed an opposition. So after all the talk about how Wales would cope without Sean and without Gatland, they are in a pretty impressive start, certainly in the defensive perspective. And five tries as well, job done, bonus point. I mean, it wasn't perfect. There were issues at the scrum. There were a few other issues in certain areas. But, you know, the team entered through Gatland's gate and kind of left through Pivac's portal to the future already, because it was... there were little changes there and little signs of how things are going to develop. He's used the word evolve a lot, evolution rather than revolution, and we've started to see the evolution.
Is George North at outside centre a part of that evolution? Is that a firm fixture, or do you think it's just a stopgap?
I think with Tompkins having come on and made the impact that he did, both in terms of the first try, it's a long time since I've seen international centre throw a bullet 20 metre pass like that.
Yeah.
Not just that, but if you wanted to show any 7 or 8 girls starting the game how to execute a 2-on-1, you'd show them the lead up to the actual George North try that was disallowed. Ball in two hands, target the inside shoulder, draw the man, give the pass. Very basic. And how many times have you seen that messed up at international level? So he's the real deal. I think everyone's of the view of that. So I think he's going to be a future in the centre. So I think that really means George North more likely than not moving to the wing again, where you know he's a fairly experienced international, 40 test tries now to his name. So, yeah, I don't see the centre thing being sustained with Tompkins coming back, and also Owen Watkins fit again now. So yeah, the crisis that Wales had in the centre has been ameliorated to some extent.
Okay, a lot of praise as well for the performance of Dan Biggar, who I have to say, Simon, I've always been a huge fan of, you know, right back to the days of the Ospreys. He obviously went to Northampton. Chris Boyd and I has done a lot of work with him, and he had a very good game as well at fly half. Why is it that Dan Biggar gets a bit of a rough ride from Wales fans from time to time?
I mean, I think that's changed a little bit over the last few years. Well, funny, in Wales, it tends to go in cycles. There's certain people every couple of years who gets it in the neck. Alex Cuthbert had it. Rhys Priestland had it. If you hear now, you'll find the person that's been getting it most recently is George North. It's a funny one. We're not happy, I think, unless we've got someone to give a hard time to. But there's real recognition, real respect for Dan Biggar, you know. And he's had a lot of weight on his shoulders with Gareth Anscombe out for long term. Anscombe obviously was the starting fly half in the Grand Slam last season. But Dan is probably playing the rugby of his life at the moment. He's flourishing under Chris Boyd in Northampton. And, you know, he's a proud son of Swansea, went to school at Gowerton, but you'd think it was a Fijian on the pitch last week with that flick through his legs. It was the kind of thing Wasile Serebi would have been proud of. And he's just playing with a lot of confidence. He's never been short of confidence, Dan, but he's even more assured than ever at the moment. And it's a nice mix with him starting and Jared Evans coming off the bench, because Jared is probably one of the most dangerous players with ball in hand in European rugby. So, yeah, with a nice mix there.
And I have to say, I really admire that confidence level, because given particularly what happened to Anscombe, so Dan Biggar has had to take an awful lot of responsibility on his shoulders, and he has grown with that. Some players, maybe they shy away slightly when there's so much pressure on them. But Dan Biggar, as you said, maybe some people read it as a little bit of arrogance, but I think it's fantastic to have that much confidence when really you're the only main option really at the moment, Evans aside.
Yeah, he's a born fighter as well. People don't almost realise that, but that boy's put his body on the line so many times for the Ospreys and Wales. And he's a controller. He's probably one of the best players in the world in terms of his work in the air, reclaiming kicks. He never gives up a lost cause. And he's now starting, as I say, to sort of really develop in kind of a broader attacking game as well. Although we could see a lot of that at the Ospreys as well. It's a nice mix, and then you've got Thomas Williams inside, who's a real crackerjack as well. So, yeah, Wales' attacking game has been the big talk. Wayne Pivac said, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. We've got a good defence, we've got good discipline, we tend to produce a fair bit of first phase ball. The key is evolving the attack, and after a couple of games, bar, and it's really, we are starting to see that attack taking different shapes, and it's the variety of the attack that's the interesting thing at the moment.
You mentioned scrum half there. Rhys Webb got 20 minutes last week. Williams came off. You've got Gareth Davies in the mix there as well. You've got three cracking scrum halves at the moment, Simon. And I'm just wondering what you think of the chances of Rhys Webb forcing his way back into that nine jersey position. It's a tough road ahead of him.
I think realistically, when everyone's fit, Rhys is probably third in the pecking order. Gareth Davies was starting scrum half for most of last year at the Grand Slam and for the World Cup match, the semi-final. He's so important to Wales in terms of the role he plays. He's given a free role in defence. In broken field, there's few more dangerous runners. The ball and Gareth, you saw his interception against Australia. So he can finish like a wing. Thomas Williams, I think, will be the Lions' test scrum half in 2021. People need to see, who haven't seen much of this kid. He's
very
special. Mm-hmm. He is like the moment last week where he sort of juggled the ball in midair and kind of looking around the complete, you know, almost dismissive nature of everything that was happening. That shows a boy who has a long background playing basketball. He's got all the skills. He just makes things happen. He's so sharp, so quick. Yeah, so I think at the moment, Rhys has got a lot of work to kind of force away ahead of those two in the pecking order.
You know, when teams are evenly matched, no matter what sport, it seems to be the team that wants it more, has a better attitude on the day, it seems to edge it. I might get your thoughts on this in a second. We're just going to hear a clip from Cian Healy, who was asked if the way the Irish provinces, the channel they have to express their emotion and they will go on long European runs against the Welsh situation, where the clubs are generally not in the running order, or it's not in the mix at the end. And we just asked them if Ireland can do anything to work on matching the passion.
I'm not sure it's matched them. You know, we've got a lot of national pride and we've got a lot of club pride. And, you know, this came up years ago about in one of the infamous meetings of play for your country as you play for your club. And that's not really an issue here. Lads come in here and it becomes one team. You know, you're expecting higher standards across the board, and we enjoy doing what we do. We enjoy being together, and that without any effort creates a drive to succeed together and to enjoy those times.
So is that, do you think, an ingredient why Wales are so successful, three-time semi-finalists, Grand Slam champions three times over the last few years, that because they don't have success with their province, it all gets channeled into the national effort?
I mean, there's a big thing, there's a couple of key points to look at here. You know, when Wales are able to put their first string group of players on the field, top 30 players, there's a lot of quality there. What you have at the regional level is you simply don't have the strength, quality strength and depth that top Irish, top English and top French sides get. I mean, at the end of the day, you generally pay for what you get in life. You know, money isn't the only thing in professional sport, but it's by far the most important thing. And if you look at the respective budgets of the sides we talk about there, well, the performances are pretty much on a par with those. If you pay a playing budget of £4.8 million, which is what the Dragons have, compared to £7, £8, £9 million of the top teams in Europe, well, it's what you're going to happen. It's what's going to happen, isn't it? Mm. But obviously, the playing budgets don't apply in international rugby. It's just you gather all the players from all the different places. We still have a number of players who play outside of Wales. There's currently 97 Welsh qualified players, professionals in England. Imagine taking 97 professionals out of Ireland. The provinces will probably struggle a bit, wouldn't they?
Absolutely. Absolutely, 100%. Like the last few meetings between Wales and Ireland, I don't know how much Warren Gatland had to do with that, Simon, and his association here previously. But certainly in terms of rivalry now, Ireland-Wales is right up there. Physicality, I mean, the hits going in over the last few years have just been immense from both teams. And there's no reason to expect that things will be anyway softer under Wayne Pivac, is there?
No, there's not. And there's another aspect which is coming to the equation, which is that Sam Warburton is now on board in the coaching team as the breakdown consultant. And you can see an immediate impact from him in the game against Italy. Wales now are being very, very circumspect and considered at the breakdown. It's essentially just two men going in, so at most two men. But what they're doing is that classic trait that Warburton has, which is picking their times to go and attack the ball. You saw Tipperick do it.
Yeah.
You saw Tompkins do it. And you can look already after a few weeks a team coached by Warburton in that area. And what obviously, if you do that, if you just commit those couple of people, but commit them judiciously, it allows you to fan out in defence across the field, and then you become very hard to break down. If there is one area of physicality or physical collisions that we do have a concern about, it's the situation of our scrum. It's been a little bit of a bugbear for a while now going into the World Cup. We struggled in the two warm-up games against Ireland, the scrum, and I think a large part of that was getting to grips with the new interpretations of the scrummaging techniques, which Wales probably went for and then realised nobody else was doing. went back to plan A.
Yeah.
And last weekend, there were, against a couple of young Italian props, there were a few creaks along the way. So that will be a concern, because Tyke Furlong, I think, is the best tight end in the world. He is hugely experienced, and you've got Porter and Kilcoyne coming off the bench. That is going to be a big area. If Wales struggle there, it could be a long day, because you have CJ Stander running off strong scrum ball and Omani causing problems with the breakdown on attacking ball, then we will struggle. So the scrum is an absolutely key area for Wales this weekend.
And just finally, before I let you go, Toby Faletau back in at number 8, and it does seem to give a beautiful balance to that back row, with Wainwright, who had a very good World Cup, Tipperick as well, your out-and-out open-side jackal, and then Faletau, who can pretty much do everything but just seems to suck in huge amounts of attention, particularly with ball in hand.
Well, it says everything that, probably our most consistent back row forward over the last year has been Josh Navidi over the last 2 years. You know, he's missing, unfortunately, with a hamstring strain. And despite that, he still put a quartet of Tipperick, Wainwright, Faletau and Moriarty in the 23. And then you've got Aaron Shingler, who's probably the best line-out forward in Wales as well there. So we are very blessed. There's no Ellis Jenkins, no James Davis. I can go on. There's about 12 back row players who could all come in and do a job. We just seem to churn out 7s, 6s and 8s in Wales. Yeah. And the return of Fallett, that was a huge boost because he's a general world-class player. He looked a little bit off the pace maybe last week. Rusty is understandable. He's only had two or three games in a year. But I think he'll have benefited from that run out against Italy, and hopefully you'll see him more like his normal self on the weekend if selected.
Simon, enjoy the Irish hospitality this weekend, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us. Appreciate it.
No problem. Take care.
Super. Simon Thomas there from Wales Online, giving us the view from Wales ahead of this weekend. Would you be confident, Mick, or would you be a little bit apprehensive given that we were really outfought for large parts of the game last weekend?
I would say that when Wales looked at the Ireland game, they would have taken an awful lot of confidence, and it was probably the last thing that we needed them to do from that. They probably would have identified a lot of areas and again sensed it overall that 2019 still lingers. I'm looking at the team that started in Cardiff, so you can disregard the two warm-up games before the World Cup.
Yeah.
There's nine guys who started in Cardiff. Missing Rob Kearney, Keith Earls, Gary Ringross, Rory Best, Sean O'Brien.
Sean O'Brien, sorry, yeah.
And Tadhg Byrne. But I guess if Ringross and Earls were, and Earls was fully fit, they would have been in there as well. And there's, I mean, I think Wales will come in with the confidence. They're always talking about momentum in this competition, and if they come in with the confidence that they can to beat Ireland, I'd just be slightly worried about Ireland's Ireland's levels in that regard.
Set up for an absolute cracker. The Irish women's team last weekend got their campaign off with a win against Scotland. It wasn't perfect by any means, but again, a bit like the men, and very important to start with victory to keep the campaign momentum going. Damien O'Mara has been talking to Claire Keohane ahead of Wales this weekend. It's a fixture that Ireland lost for the first time last year in the Arms Park, and they'll be keen to get things right this weekend.
Claire, I suppose the place to start, congratulations. You've had a fairly storied sporting career and another new chapter written last week. Is it a relief as much as anything else to finally get that first cap?
Yeah, you know, that's a good way to put it too. You know, it's certainly, I'm so glad to just, you know, get that box ticked almost without sounding ungrateful. It was a fantastic day for me, you know, a fantastic day for my family. But yeah, certainly just delighted to get that under my belt.
Can you enjoy it? Because obviously when you're on the bench, you have to be tuned into what's going on around you. You can't be sitting there agonising over when this call is going to come.
I suppose, you know, you enjoy it as much as you can, more so that evening, maybe when I was with my family and when we left camp and I had an hour or two to spend with my family and friends. It kind of sank in that, you know, I'd got over the line, I suppose, and you know, there's a couple of hours there to enjoy it on that Sunday evening.
It's been remarkable though, like inter-county career, club career, sevens career, medical studies in the background, and now a fully fledged 15s international. Like, how do you manage to squeeze so much into a life that most of the rest of us struggle to do one or two things?
I have a lot of support from a lot of people, you know. I suppose I don't really do it on my own. You know, I suppose, you know, growing up, I was playing football. I was very young, you know, man in that Cork squad with fantastic footballers who I suppose still, you know, I look up to today. You know, the Angela Walshes, the Geraldine O'Flynns, these are the girls who I aspired to be when I grew up, you know. So I had fantastic exposure to high performance sport before we even labelled it as high performance sport, you know. You know, the natural progression for me was back into rugby. And yeah, I suppose I've enjoyed it ever since.
I'm sure, no doubt, you get asked which one, what's the highlight? Is it success with the club? Is it success with the county? Is it success with Ireland? Or are they all very different achievements or all very different associations?
Different memories and different moments, I suppose. As a, you know, probably growing up with a bunch of girls at home in Inch Rovers, winning our club All-Ireland in 2010. It's probably a sporting moment that's very difficult to look past, you know, winning a Club All-Ireland, you know, be it, you know, ladies football, hurling, football. It's an incredibly difficult task to do. And, you know, when we got that win in 2010, it probably is up there with my proudest sporting achievements. It is my proudest sporting achievement, without a doubt. But obviously getting my first international cap at the weekend and getting my first sevens international cap a few years ago, they're all different, but, you cherish them equally.
So you would have been a GAA household initially. Is your brother played rugby, and is that how you got into rugby? And like so many players, probably came to it relatively late in your sporting life compared to, you know, we expect kids to pick up stuff from a very, very young age.
Yeah, I mean, I was very lucky. You know, the house I grew up in, both my parents, you know, we were allowed play any sport, play any instrument. You know, they exposed us to as much as we possibly could. You know, looking back, I don't know how they did it, to be honest. from a rugby perspective, I actually played rugby in Yall Rugby Club up until I was 10 or 11. I played with the boys. I loved every minute of it. My brother was playing in Yall and my dad had played, and I went in on a Sunday morning, a Saturday morning, and that's probably where my love for rugby began. Unfortunately, at the time, there wasn't a pathway there for women to continue playing kind of that, between that age back between 12 and 18. The great thing is there is now. So for me, the natural progression was into Camogie and football and then back to rugby. So.
In a strange way then, are you almost envious of the generation of girls who stand at that fence, and I don't know how one of them hasn't toppled over onto the pitch after a match at some stage, that like we are so accustomed now to seeing this squad sign everything that is put in front of them because that pathway is there, and that sense that you can now inspire someone from a very young age straight up to the international level, which perhaps wasn't the case in previous years.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose majority of the girls playing when we were growing up, rugby wasn't a possibility for us. But now, I mean, the pathways that the IRFU have in place in the provinces means that, you know, there's girls coming through now, you know, when they're 17, 18, they'll have played, you know, 5-10 times the rugby, if not more, that I'll have played in my entire lifetime. So, you know, it's very exciting. And certainly, you know, you look at Baden Parsons, you look at some of the younger players in the squad coming through, and, you know, they're pushing and they're driving that standard, and, you know, everybody feeds off that.
To speak of the weekend, great to get back to winning ways for the squad, and great to start this campaign with a very, very hard-fought win.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, opening game to Six Nations, it's just all about momentum, isn't it? You know, it's all about getting that first win at home and getting that little bit of confidence, and, you know, everybody's so excited about getting into camp today. And, you know, I suppose we feel that we didn't put in a performance for the full 80 minutes, and that's something that we'll be revisiting this weekend and hoping to build on that.
But there's plenty of positives that can be taken, like the clinical aspect of that first 15 minutes, which gave you the foundation for the win, and maybe as much so the defensive nature and the resolute aspects of large spells of the game, where in previous times maybe Irish sides would have coughed up a defeat.
Yeah, I mean, we were very happy, you know, when we did our review as a backline kind of after the game, we were particularly happy with that opening passage of play, that opening 25 minutes, and we felt that we played the rugby that we wanted to play. Yeah, you know, it's about, you know, bringing that consistency now for the weekend, and certainly in defence, you know, our philosophy is, you know, get the ball back as quickly as we can, and you know, we want to be aggressive in our defence too. And certainly, you know, I suppose the weekend, yeah, wasn't a consistent 80-minute performance, but we're hungry to go again and to rectify that.
And it's almost the perfect storm, isn't it, that you're up and running with a win, but yes, there does seem to be a little bit of a frustration that you didn't put in that 80-minute performance, that there is still so much more to come from this squad this weekend.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, you spend all of November, you know, December, January building towards the Six Nations, and, you know, you want to put in the performance that you know you're capable of. And I suppose as a group, you know, we know what we're capable of, and we want to show that, you know, to a home crowd at the weekend, and I suppose be consistent for that 80 minutes.
And it's probably the two teams that are the most familiar with each other in certainly European women's rugby, because you've faced off on so many occasions in the past. So can we expect maybe the margins to be fairly tight this weekend?
We're very familiar with Wales, as are they with us. You know, we had a training camp with them only a couple of weeks ago, so we know the physicality and the pride and the passion that they're going to bring on the day. And I suppose we'll have to front up and match that and make sure that we, I suppose, implement the game plan we want to play and take it from there.
So that was Claire Keohane speaking to Damien ahead of the match on Sunday. It's live on RT television as well. Live coverage across the weekend, of course, Radio 1, Michael Corcoran and Donal Lenihan on Saturday for the big one on the under-20s tomorrow night in Cork. It's a live television from 7 o'clock on RT2 with Dara and the panel. And then on Sunday as well, we're back for the Women's International. So it's a feast of rugby this weekend.
And of course, the coverage online.
Of course, the coverage online as well. Yeah, absolutely. On rte.ie/sport. That's all we have time for the podcast this weekend. My thanks to Adrian Eames, who produced. My thanks to you, Mick. Enjoy the match this weekend. And Sheena Levoil on sound as well. Hope you can join us next weekend, where hopefully we're talking about Ireland making it 2 from 2.